Today is December 1st, 2023, and we're at the Amelia Island Museum of History in Fernandina Beach, Florida. The following interview is being conducted as part of the Amelia Island Museum of History's Heritage Keepers Project. Today, we're interviewing Jim Corbett. My name's Jarrett Hill, and I'll be interviewing Mr. Corbett on behalf of the museum. Mr. Corbett, how are you doing today?
Just fine, thank you.
Good. Could you tell me, when did you first arrive in Fernandina?
I was born here.
All right, that's one way to arrive.
1948. All
right. Could you tell me a little bit about your family at that time?
Well, my uncle came here in 1921. He was the oldest in the family. Mm-hmm. He's born in 1900. His name was Tracy Corbett. Tracy James, a lot of people called him TJ. My dad, X. Dean Corbett, mm-hmm. was born in 1917. He was the youngest in the family. Tracy was the oldest. Tracy got a job at Nassau Fertilizer and Oil Company, mm-hmm. better known as the Pogie Plant. And my dad and Tracy's parents both died around 1921. So my dad was kind of pawned off on all the siblings until he got to Tracy. And when he came one summer to stay with my Uncle Tracy, mm-hmm. my Uncle Tracy just said, I don't feel like driving all the way back to West Florida, so you can stay here with me. And that's what he did. So he grew up in Fernandina, and he graduated from high school in 1936, Fernandina Beach High. Well, Fernandina High School at that time. Mm-hmm. And my Uncle Tracy eventually took over operations at Nassau Fertilizer, and he died of asthma in 1949, mm-hmm. and that's when my dad, X. Dean Corbett, took over Nassau Fertilizer and Oil Company. Nassau Fertilizer was incorporated in 1921. It was basically... the company itself started in 1911 and went bankrupt. And so there was a big farming family in Denmark, South Carolina that bought the company. Mm-hmm. They hired my uncle as an auditor, and eventually he worked his way up to running the place. And when he died in 1949, my dad took over. And my dad ran the place probably until about 1978, and he kind of retired, and I took over. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, my two brothers, Charles and Tom, also were involved, at least in the summertime, employed out there. Mm-hmm. But my brother went on to bigger and better things. My younger brother, Tom, he worked with the company. He was a fisherman, fished on the boats until, I guess the late 1970s, mm-hmm. when we ceased our fishing operations. And then he went back to college and went on to bigger and better things.
Mm-hmm. All right. So if I could clarify a little bit, you said there was a South Carolina family who hired your Uncle Tracy. Was that South Carolina family based in Fernandina? Were there two separate plants?
They were farmers.
Okay.
And basically what we did, first of all, there were three separate Pogie plants in Fernandina, mm-hmm. all on the same property out there at the end of North 14th Street. Mm-hmm. You had Quinn Manhattan. It was owned by the Quinn family. You had Nassau Fertilizer and Oil Company. Then you had the Smith family had a third Pogie plant all out there on the same property. Now, as time moved on, you have to understand that in 1900, there were 200 Pogie plants on the east coast of the United States. Mm-hmm. Okay? In 2000, 100 years later, there were two. So the Menhaden business had a short span of about 100 years. Mm-hmm. Now, what caused the decline in that is split three ways. You slice that pie for overfishing, mm-hmm. destruction of habitat, which didn't allow the resource to keep multiplying as fast as it had, mm-hmm. and of course pollution, and the pollution factor was also something that kept the resource from multiplying as fast as it did at one mm-hmm. time. Now, how you cut that, how you slice that up, who knows, but those are the three main factors that caused the decline in the resource. And where Quinman Hayden and the Smith Pogey plant, they were a large conglomerate that had fishing at other locations, mm-hmm. and they just packed their boats and their equipment and moved to one of their other locations, yeah. where we were a small independent at Nassau Fertilizer, so we stayed, didn't have anywhere to go, mm-hmm. and whereas the Smith people probably left Fernandina in the early 60s, Quinman Hayden left in probably the mid-70s, mm-hmm. and then Nassau Fertilizer eventually stopped processing fish in the late 1980s.
Okay.
And then after that, we turned the property into like a little small industrial park, mm-hmm. catering to local commercial businesses that needed warehouse space or dock space, a little bit of open space, some office space, and things like that.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested that you say one of the reasons that led to the Menhaden industry's decline was pollution. Mm-hmm. Other individuals I've spoken to that lived in Fernandina at that time have talked pretty frequently about the water pollution that the mills produced. Mm-hmm. Did you encounter that as a factor while you were out, you know, running the pogey plants?
It's hard to say.
Sure. I know
it's hard to say. I don't think that I could prove it. I think one of the things that's a little bit different in the species that we sought and caught, mm-hmm. A menhaden is considered a trash fish. And by that I mean it swims with its mouth open and it eats plankton, mm-hmm. and whatever's in the water. Now, some of the effluent that the paper mills put out had an awful lot of sugar in it, mm-hmm. which would have perhaps been something that the menhaden would have liked to have swam around and had some of. Mm-hmm. It's just hard to say. As opposed to some of the other species that don't swim around with their mouths open and eat other fish. Menhaden, one female menhaden is capable of producing 200,000 eggs.
Wow.
Okay? So the species travels in large spools. Mm-hmm. And so the schools of the fish, most people feel like they travel together for protection. Now, the predator fish that eat the menhaden eat on the fringes. Mm-hmm. They come along and take a bite here and a bite there on the fringes of the large schools of fish. But the safety is in numbers, so to speak, because they can't eat them all. Mm-hmm. But the menhaden are kind of like some of the other marine species in the sense that the eggs are spawned in the ocean. They wash up into the estuaries and are hatched, and then as they grow up, they move offshore into the saltier water. Mm-hmm. The rainwater and runoffs and stuff like that, affects the salinity of the water and drives them offshore. And that's where the pollution factor comes in. Mm-hmm. The pollution factor comes in your inland waters where they first are born, so to speak, and grow up. Some of them die before they even have a chance to get to the ocean. Destruction of habitat, where you fill in the wetlands for, housing developments or more industrial stuff. Mm-hmm. It takes away those fertile breeding grounds, not necessarily breeding grounds, but the growing up grounds. Doesn't give some of those eggs a chance to even hatch, mm-hmm. much less grow up, and you got less space for them to grow up in. So those are where the pollution and the destruction of habitat come in. There's just not as much area and as clean water for these young eggs to grow up in and go offshore and grow up, so to speak.
So I'm curious about the process of, you know, going out and catching these fish. How did you spot these schools of fish?
Well, originally when the business started, they had a so-called crow's nest on the boats. Mm-hmm. And you'd climb the crow's nest, and it was up high, and you could spot the fish whipping on top of the water. You could follow the seagulls that like to eat the pogies as well. Mm-hmm. And they would dive into a school of pogies. And, of course, at that time, you know, throughout the teens and the 20s and the 30s, the resource was a lot higher, and they're a lot easier to spot from the vessel. Mm-hmm. As time went on, especially after the Second World War, we started using airplanes to spot the fish. We'd have an airplane guy that, of course, he's a licensed pilot, but he was an experienced pogey spotter, so to speak, and he would radio down to the boats where he saw large schools of fish, and then we could capture them that way. One thing here, I should just give you an idea of how things work. The process we had is we had a mothership. In our case, was about 120 feet long. Mm-hmm. And then we had two smaller vessels about 35 feet long that actually did the fishing. And we used a purse seine. Now, a purse seine is a large rectangular net that would drop down 60 feet deep if necessary. Mm-hmm. Okay? And it was about half a mile of actual net that we would circle the fish. Here you see each purse boat has got half the net in it. And the net is laid in the purse boat where it can be dragged out. So they would run side by side with each other. Here you can see, like this is a good example of a place of fish right there. The fish would appear to be like a big black dot. Mm-hmm. In the blue ocean. And then in our case, the radio operator on the boat would hear the airplane. Mm-hmm. And he would direct them where the fish, and then they dropped the purse boats down. They would actually do the fishing. Mm-hmm. And come up on, and you'd hear the airplane pilot, "All right, open up. And so they start to spread apart, but mm-hmm. you see in this picture here. And they would circle the fish. You can see them going around the fish. Yeah. Here they're going around, and they meet together. Now, you see, this is all fish in the net right here. Mm-hmm. All of that. And so the net had corks on the top line. Keep the net floating up. Mm-hmm. And it had metal rings all around the bottom. And those metal rings had a rope that went through each one of the metal rings all the way around. So that once the net was set, we'd throw a big tom weight overboard. Sure. That had pulleys on it. And the pulleys contained that same rope. And you'd pull it.
And it would like close.
And close it up. Yeah. Like a woman's handbag or a woman's purse. Sure. But turn it upside down, the purse that is. Yeah. And that's how we would close the net. And then you'd work your excess webbing or net back into the purse boat. Mm-hmm. You had to be real careful how you put it back in there, because that's the way it was going to come out. Mm-hmm. And you didn't want a fowl to come along and screw up the hole next time you set the net. Now, once you got all the excess net up, you come alongside the mothership and form a triangle. Mm-hmm. So you can imagine the two purse boats coming along, and then they come to the mothership and form a triangle. Then we had a big 10-inch hose. I'm looking at this upside down, okay. But you see that hose?
Yes, sir.
And on the end of the hose, it had a metal frame that would prevent large fish from being sucked up in that 10-inch hose. And you would prime that with a pump. Mm-hmm. Okay, and then the fish would be sucked up with the water, come on board the boat, and I think I got a picture here somewhere. Yeah, there's a housing here that the water and the fish together would fall into that housing, and the water would go through the slats mm-hmm. in the housing and go off the other side of the boat, and the fish would fall on that housing and slide into the fish hole, minus the majority of the water. And then when we got back to the factory, we had a 10-inch pipe that ran down into the fish hole. And so we take water hoses and flood the fish hole with water,
mm-hmm.
and then have a fish pump on the dock. We crank up that pump, and it start pumping the water out of the fish hole, and it would pump it up into the processing area on a metal grate, and the water would go through the grate. The fish would fall on the grate and go in to be processed. So that's how we got them off.
With such a large net, I can only imagine how many fish were caught at a time.
Well, the main vessel we had would hold about 200 tons of raw fish.
Wow.
And then that would produce about 70 tons of fish meal. What we produced was fish meal as opposed to fertilizer. Now, the fish meal was used as fertilizer. Originally, that was its use as fertilizer. You probably recall hearing stories about the Pilgrims and how the Indians taught them how to put a fish when they planted the corn. And speculation is pretty high that probably was a menhaden that they were using.
Mm-hmm.
And so after the Second World War, you had a lot of synthetic fertilizers that came on the market.
Mm-hmm.
The 10-10-10s and the 25-10s and all this kind of good stuff with the nitrogen and the potash that they came out to use as fertilizers.
Mm-hmm.
And that was some pretty stiff competition for the organic fertilizer that the fish meal was mm-hmm. versus the inorganic fertilizer that was being used at that time. So there was an effort made to find another use, and so animal rations became the main use for the fish meal,
mm-hmm.
mostly poultry. It turns out that the fish meal was pretty rich in amino acids, which is basically protein.
Mm-hmm.
And so two of the most important amino acids for the growth of poultry, that is chickens, was lysine and methionine,
mm-hmm.
which was prevalent in pretty high portions in the fish meal. And it could increase the growth rate of a chicken.
Hmm.
In other words, they could take the chicken and grow it from the time it hatched 4 pounds where it was ready to be processed in a shorter amount of time,
mm-hmm.
and it would help increase their profits if the price of what they were eating was into a formula, so to speak.
Sure.
But for a long time, they did not know exactly how it worked, but they knew if you used fish meal, you could grow the chicken faster. And after a lot of research, they came up with the idea that it was those two amino acids that were found in the fish meal that produced the rapid growth rate in the chicken. It's also used in hog feed, horse feed, even feed alligators at alligator farms.
Really? So did that become the plant's primary income? Was okay.
Mm-hmm. Now, the oil, the fish oil, is basically the fat that's in the fish.
Mm-hmm.
Just like you take milk and run it through a centrifuge and you get the cream, which is the fat that's in the milk. Well, we did something very similar with centrifuges to get the fat out of the liquid part of the fish.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the process was to run the whole fish through a steam heat to break down the fish. We run it through a press to press the liquid out of it.
Mm-hmm.
We take that liquid and run it. We'd heat it up to anything over 180 degrees would begin to break the fat away from the rest of the liquid. And you run it through a centrifuge and you could get that out of it. And so the fish oil was not a good fertilizer. It would kill things. But early on, before the centrifuges came into place, they'd take all that, what we used to call stink water, the liquid that came out of the presses, and put it in huge tanks that would have steam heat running in the bottom of it. And once you got it up to a certain temperature, anything over 180 degrees, that fish oil would rise to the top so that you could turn the spigot to empty those big tanks and let the water run out of it. And when you got down to the oil, you cut that spigot off and turned on another one to put it into a tank. But fish oil was used with the cosmetic industries for a long time as a base for lipsticks, rouge, all kind of powder. My dad used to kid all the ladies at church about Poke Plant had a little bit of a reputation of having an odor. And he said, well, don't get too crazy about it because you probably got a little fish oil on your lips right now. But now what most of the cosmetic companies do is they use a synthetic oil of some kind that's replaced that. Fish oil for years was used in a lot of countries in Europe, mostly in Northern Europe, as a base for margarines, the same way that vegetable oils are used in this country. When I grew up, we had a lot of what we called oleo or margarine, which was a fat. A lot of animal fat is used. Crisco, fat in a can, is used for cooking. And fish oil in certain countries was used pretty prevalently in cooking oils.
Okay.
The FDA, we had a hard time dealing with them trying to get fish oil approved for human consumption. It was a big lobby from the oleo people to not have it approved. And so a majority of the fish oil was shipped over to Europe to be used over there for cooking oils that wasn't allowed to use in this country. Now, in addition to that, the fish oil was used in paints. You may have seen advertising for Rust-Oleum contains fish oil, and that fish oil would lay a base on the metal, and then it would be covered up by the paint naturally as part of the paint process, so to speak. We used to mix fish oil with Bunker C, which is number 6 fuel oil, which is a real thick petroleum product that a lot of people burn in their boilers to create steam, which we did as well. But you have to heat it up in order to use it. But if you heat it up and put a little fish oil in it and mop it onto a tank or a roof, you know, the cold will thicken up the number 6 fuel oil, and the fish oil, by nature, settles down on the metal with the Bunker C protecting it. Now, the problem you got is occasionally you might have a little drip in the summertime when it gets pretty doggone hot. But it was a great rust preventative that was used instead of paints. And it was pretty inexpensive. The fish oil is one of the products that we sold, as well as the fish meal. Eventually, we got to the point where we would take, instead of throwing that water overboard that we ran through a centrifuge to get the oil out of it, we would run it through a series of heat to evaporate the actual H2O in it. And what you had left over was kind of a soup, but it was a lot of suspended particles that were in that product. We used to call it fish solubles. And you could use that as a fertilizer. A lot of the hardware stores used to sell a product called fish emulsion. Now, with that product, it would spoil if you didn't stabilize we used to use sulfuric acid to stabilize it. Now, if you sold it as a fertilizer, you would use phosphoric acid to stabilize it, which would increase the phosphorus content and make it a better fertilizer. But we sold it that the fish solubles would be added into chicken feed or any other kind of animal feed. And, you know, it was sold as a feed ingredient as well.
Okay.
So we really produced three different products, the fish meal, the fish solubles, and the fish oil.
Okay.
And we threw nothing away.
It sounds like it.
Eventually. Now, early on, you know, they threw a lot of that so-called stink water away until they found a way to evaporate the actual water out of it and get those suspended solids and be able to, you know. And it got to the point where the state made us do that so we wouldn't throw stuff back into the water. But we were already doing it anyway. But there were times when the fish soluble market was such that it cost us money to produce it, so to speak, to run it through all that heat. But we still had to do it.
Sure.
To keep it, we you know, we were a 100% organic business and put nothing back into the water.
So stepping a little bit back, I'm curious, when did you first become involved with the plant?
Well, of course, I was born into the industry.
Sure, sure.
And I first started working out there. I probably around 1962 is when I was about 14 years old. I started working there, and I continued to work there until 2020. So, do the math.
Did you work specific roles? Like, were you more of an administrator? Did you go on
well,
the boat?
In my younger days, I did a little bit of everything.
Okay.
I worked in the processing plant, worked on the boats. And then, of course, as my dad got older, I got more involved from a management point of view. And, of course, when he retired, I took over the management of the company. So it was a training thing to start at the bottom and work your way up.
Sure, sure.
Just like we all did, so to speak.
So you were out on the boats with some of the crews that worked there.
Yeah, in my younger days, absolutely. And I worked in the plant quite a bit.
Okay, all right.
As well.
Now, something that I think Nassau Fertilizer is pretty well known in these parts for is being one of the historically largest employers of Black Floridians, Black Fernandinans. Did a lot of those workers come from the area? Were they coming from elsewhere in the state, or were they generally pulled from local populations? Do you remember?
Most of them local. You know, I guess in those days, to some degree, their employment opportunities were somewhat limited. In our case, a fisherman's a fisherman. And I know when we had a lot of progress going on in the country, from an integration point of view, in the Civil Rights Act, we had some lawyers come by and talk to my dad and I about was 10% of our workforce black? And the way they worded it, we said no. And so they went on to tell us about the new laws that were going. And then finally one of them asked the right question, which was, what percentage of your workforce is black? And my dad said, well, I'd need to go check the books to give you an exact answer, but it's approximately 80 to 90%. They packed their bags and their law books and closed their briefcases and left. Because it didn't apply to us. Neil Frink was one of the first black pogey captains on the east coast of the United States, which was one of our employees through the years. His son is very active, I think, here.
Yes, sir.
Now. And it was interesting because Neil and I go to St. Peter's Episcopal Church, and which which is one of the first churches to integrate. And I remember talking with Neil one day, and I said, "Neil, you know, you and I are doing something that our daddies didn't do." He said, "What's that?" I said, "We go to church together." So anyway, times have changed from that point of view.
Yeah.
But we had a lot of great black help, very, very capable. And Captain Neal, the way the fishermen were paid was from like a piecemeal. They got paid by how much fish they caught.
Mm-hmm.
And different positions on the boat paid different amounts. You could come off from 10 cents well, we called it 1,000 fish, but it was a certain amount of fish. They got paid anywhere from a dime to the captain got 50 cents.
Mm-hmm.
And what Captain Neal would do is he would give up some of his money, his 50 cents. Mm-hmm. He might give a 2 cents to a guy that's a first mate, and he might be the best first mate around. So as an incentive to go fish with him, he gave him 2 cents of his money.
Yeah.
And right on down the line, even the cook might get an extra penny if he was a good cook. And by doing that, he gave up money, but he made more up because his boat was always the leading boat as far as the amount of fish caught.
Sure.
He more than made up with it having a good crew by the number of fish that he caught. And a lot of the white captains used to complain about that, but my daddy didn't take too much of that.
Mm-hmm.
He just said, "You get out there and do the job." And because it was pretty obvious what Neil was doing. He was helping his guys out to get the best ones, and he caught more fish than anybody.
Was there ever any issues with how the workers were treated by the people of the town with such a high percentage of black workers?
Not that I know of. Now, for years, we tied our boats up at where David Cook is right now, downtown. And that allowed the fishermen to walk to the boat and then go out fish and stop by the plant to unload. And they come back to the downtown dock and, you know, they could walk home. And so as far as I know, you know, I don't know of any big discrimination. I know we had some black help that was a little hesitant to take leadership roles in the company, whether it be in the plant or on a boat, simply because they didn't want to have to go back to their neighborhood after having fired somebody and live with that rejection from somebody in their neighborhood, so to speak.
Sure.
So they didn't want to take on leadership roles because of that, even though, in our opinion, they were the best person for the job. That's just the way they looked at it. Yeah. So they continued to do a good job in their role that they felt comfortable in, so to speak. Does that make sense to you?
Absolutely. I mean, it's interesting to hear you mention that and, you know, the fact that boats would dock right by the town and people could walk into town, because that type of small town Fernandina seems so different than what we have today.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was a whole different thing. Now, what you have to understand is between the three companies, I'm talking about during the Great Depression, each one of the three companies fished at least 5 boats.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? They were smaller boats that didn't hold the 200 tons that I was telling you about with the last boat that we had. But they would hold, you know, 80 to 90. Sometimes if they deck loaded it, they might get 100 tons on the boat. But you had 26 people on a crew.
Mm-hmm.
So you take 15 boats times 26. You can imagine how many people were employed just in the fishing part. That doesn't include the three operating manufacturing plants that probably had 30, 40, 50, 60 people employed there.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it was a big employer on the island in that time. I know, speaking strictly for Nassau Fertilizer, during the Great Depression, my Uncle Tracy minted Nassau Fertilizer coins, okay? And they had 1 cent, 5 cent, 10 cent, 50 cent, excuse me, 25 cent, 5, 10, 25, 50, and $1 coins, mm-hmm. okay? Nassau Fertilizer tokens. They were only redeemable at the Nassau Fertilizer store.
Mm-hmm.
We had a company store. And that's the only way we could stay open during the Great Depression. But during the Great Depression, we never closed, and we were able to provide employment for an awful lot of people.
So did the store that those tokens were exchangeable at, did that sell like
anything
food?
Mostly food,
mm-hmm.
but you could order, if your stove went out, say my stove went out, I need a stove, so the company would order the stove,
mm-hmm.
mark it up a little bit, but, at least you could get it, and, if it wasn't for the company store making a little bit of money, then you just had to shut down,
yeah.
like a lot of companies did during the Great Depression. But this way, the employment was still provided, and people were still able to eat and, raise a family, so to speak, and,
yeah.
and not go in the food lines and all that kind of good stuff. I've still got some of those tokens. I don't think I've got any with me in here, but I've got some at the house that we used, which in talking with some of the professors at some of the universities, we were not alone in doing that. A lot of companies, or some companies, I don't know if it was a lot, did that with their employees to try to keep the doors open, so to speak.
So what did the plant do during the off-season?
Well, during the off-season, we had the capabilities of putting outriggers on our boogie boats,
mm-hmm.
the big mothership, and shrimping.
Oh, okay.
So we could shrimp some during the off season as well, but other than that, you had a lot of maintenance you needed to do on the factory, so to speak. A lot of maintenance on the boats.
Mm-hmm.
Boats needed to be pulled out of the water, that is, go to dry dock, probably on an annual basis. At least our company would take them out every year. Scrape the barnacles off of them, and if they were metal boats, you had to put new anodes on them and get it painted and all kind of stuff like that. So there's a lot of maintenance that was done
mm-hmm.
During the off season. That during the season, unless it was something that you just had to fix in order to go,
mm-hmm.
You patched up until the end of the fishing season.
So mostly getting to that off-season to do the big repairs.
That's correct.
Okay.
And that included sometimes adding new equipment and stuff like that.
All right. Wonderful. When did you notice that the plant began to start to, I don't like the word decline, but
no,
start to decline?
Well, it got pretty obvious for a while because, like I said, in the early 60s, the Smith people left.
Mm-hmm.
Their fish catches were down. Part of it was this. The industry started on the Atlantic coast,
mm-hmm.
okay? And it was predominantly an Atlantic coast industry until probably the Second World War, even though it, and then they started to really go heavily into the Gulf of Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it started before then, but not to the degree that after the Second World War, the companies that were on the Atlantic coast began to move their operations in both places, the Atlantic and the Gulf.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things they did when they moved to the Gulf Coast was that from an industry-wide position, they set a starting date and they set an ending date
mm-hmm.
for the fishing season, to try to give the resource an opportunity to rebuild, as opposed to trying to catch fish year-round if you could.
Sure.
Most of the time in the winter months, the fish would go into deeper waters that, were, believe it or not, were a little bit warmer, and or go far enough offshore to where we couldn't find them. So by providing an opening date and the closing date, industry-wide, you had all the companies that were involved in the menhaden fishing business starting the same day, ending the same day, and given the resource and opportunity to rebuild itself. Mm-hmm. And because of that, and here again, it had nothing to do with the government, the menhaden industry in the Gulf of Mexico is still a pretty strong industry over there.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing that has helped them is that most of the Atlantic Coast menhaden factories, of course, were on the coast, just like the three here.
Mm-hmm.
There was one in St. Mary's. There's one in Mayport. So there was...
There were a large number in a small mm-hmm. area.
But as this country began to prosper after the Second World War, and people began to want to, you know, recreate and go to the beaches,
yeah.
they didn't want to smell the pogie plants. Okay? And so... there was a lot of pressure put on the menhaden industry to not stink.
Hmm.
And so in our case, we created a big furnace that the gases that were produced from drying the fish, which was an operation, something similar to a clothes dryer. It was a rotating big, of course, it was significantly bigger than a clothes dryer, but that's where the odor would come from.
Mm-hmm.
So... that steam, stinky steam, was sent instead of in the open air, which we didn't have to have to operate, but we would siphon it off into a big furnace and literally burn it up. But by doing that, that was 60% of our energy needs for the whole company just to run that one piece of equipment.
Yeah.
And so you might say we literally were burning up our profit because of the prosperity of the country. And eventually it got to the point where that piece of equipment, in Nassau Fertilizer's case, went on to blink. And it was right in the middle of the fishing season. So like I said, we didn't have to have it to operate. So we went to the state of Florida and asked for a variance. They declined it.
Hmm.
And so we were scared to operate without it. So we just, our fish catch had been declining. So that's when we made the decision to just shut down and not pogie fish anymore.
Okay. So was that pressure to avoid smell coming from regulation, or was that more from the people that were visiting the area?
The people visiting the area put pressure on the government, and the government, you know, trying to please the people, put pressure on the industry.
Mm-hmm.
And the industry did a pretty good job of responding to it, but the additional expense of responding to that made the business less profitable. And in our case, with the fish catches continuing to decline, even though the other two companies had left and gone on to one of their other locations, you know, it just, it made it hard to make a profit.
Sure. So after the closure of the plant, could you tell me a little bit about what the location was used for after that?
Well, what Nassau Fertilizer did was, when the Smith plant closed down,
mm-hmm.
we bought their property after they moved out. When Quinn Menhaden shut down, we bought their property. So we ended up owning all that area out there. When we shut down in the late 1980s, what we began to do is lease out dock space, warehouse space, office space, little small companies like an electric company
mm-hmm.
or woodworkers, welders, little shops. We had a lot of little warehouses out there and some big warehouses that we would rent out mm-hmm. and, of course, the dock space out there. And we're able to, you know, provide a home, for lack of a better word, for these small businesses and, of course, income for us.
Mm-hmm.
And not having any... mortgage on the property, we were able to make enough money to keep going until such time that the real estate values got to the point where, and I got to the point age-wise, and my children didn't want anything to do with it. So selling the property.
Okay.
And that's what we did.
There's one instance I read about that I wonder if you could speak a little bit more of. I heard that in the 1990s, the U.S. Navy requested bids for a dry dock.
That's correct.
In the area. Were you involved in that process at all?
Yes, and very much so. The United States Navy had a problem, and the problem was that the vessels that went in and out of Mayport,
mm-hmm.
United States Navy base at Mayport, required maintenance. And the maintenance requirements almost always involved a dry dock.
Mm-hmm.
And the closest dry dock was in Norfolk, Virginia. And so what would happen was it was a family life issue from the point of view that these guys have been out at sea for 6 months. They come home, and all of a sudden they got to go to dry dock in Virginia, so they go away from home for another month.
Mm-hmm.
And the issue was we can move that dry dock closer to Jacksonville so that these guys don't have to go up to Virginia. They can stay home for an extra month, and it'll improve their family life. And maybe we can, instead of them staying with us 3 or 4 years, they might make a career out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was their thought. So the United States Navy came to us and said, can we put your property on the book for these people that are in the dry dock business to come and speak to you about possibly using this property for the dry dock? Mm-hmm. We said, sure. So we had a company out of Norfolk, Virginia come, and we worked out an arrangement with them if they got the bid. And so they put in a bid for the dry dock. Now, when they did this, it produced quite a bit of controversy.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Sierra Club got involved. And the controversy was basically from a pollution point of view. Sometimes with dry docks, you have oversprays, you have rust and all kind of stuff that gets into the water and whatnot. Well, the reason that we decided to work with the company that we allowed to use our property to make the bid on, they had come up with a new system that the portion of the vessel, once it was out of the water, was totally enclosed with kind of like a rubber boat of some kind. If you can imagine, this huge rubber enclosure,
mm-hmm.
up against the portion of the vessel that they were working on.
Mm-hmm.
And they could totally control the climate on the inside of that. So they could heat it in the winter, they could air condition it in the summer. And if it rained, it didn't get wet. So in many instances in the dry dock, if the temperature gets down below a certain degree, the paint's no good.
Mm-hmm.
It won't do what it's supposed to do on the side of the vessel, so you can't paint. If you take and sandblast the side of a vessel, and before you can put the paint on it, it starts to rain, then you can't put the paint on, and it starts more rust, so you got to sandblast it again. So the expense of putting this cape system, they called it, up against the boat allowed them to work a regular schedule on the boat and get it out on time without having weather delays. And it had no overspray. All that went through a filter system that controlled the environment inside. And the same way with the sandblasting files and stuff like that, they just sucked it up with a vacuum cleaner,
mm-hmm.
and ran it through a filter and reused the sand. So it was as close to being pollution-free, and it was something that was relatively new from an industry point of view in the ship repair business.
Mm-hmm.
Now the problem we had, or we didn't really have it, the company had, was they didn't do a very good job of explaining that. And so there were some environmentalists they didn't want to hear it, even if it was true. Mm-hmm. And they went out of their way to spread misinformation about that process, or even deny that it was a process. Now, I personally went up to Norfolk, Virginia, and went through the whole system. And when I got on board the vessel, or not the vessel, but on the dry dock, I couldn't even tell they were working on the boat. But then when you went through two double doors to go inside that enclosure, it was pretty obvious. Everybody had masks on.
But it was just that contained.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was a great system. And the state of Florida approved it. Mm-hmm. And the state of Florida wanted these guys to come. And yet, certain people went out of their way to, oh, they paid off the state of Florida. And the long and short of it was, in our case, the company had a certain length of time to get their permits. And because of all the delays caused by the people that were against it, they were not able to meet that deadline. Mm-hmm. And so they put out a new, that is, the Navy put out a new request for a proposal, and Atlantic Marine got it. And they don't use the Cape system. What they do is just basically have a big tarp over the portion of the vessel they're working on. So, in my opinion, the environment lost because of the environmentalists not wanting it come to this location.
Mm-hmm. What have you been doing since that point? What have you been doing in your work and your life here in Fernandina?
Well, I retired in 2020 and just been enjoying life.
Glad to hear it. Changing speed just a little bit, I'm curious, how have you seen, as a longtime resident, the island change since you were born here?
Well, it's changed significantly. Some good and some not so good. But, when I grew up here, majority of the people worked at one of the paper mills. Okay? And prior to the paper mills coming to town, the fishing industry provided a significant amount of employment. Mm-hmm. The paper mills paid more, so a lot of people that were involved in the fishing industry left and went to work at the paper mills. Mm-hmm. But the fishing industry was still here, both the shrimping and, of course, the pokey plants. And but as time progressed, the fishing began to die down. The country became more and more prosperous, and that prosperity brought a lot of free time. Mm-hmm. That people wanted to recreate, come to the beach. And so we had, some big hotels come to town, especially on the south end. And when they came to town, they wanted to advertise their hotels. They created the Tourist Development Council, which main goal was to advertise the island. Mm-hmm. And they've done a very good job of advertising the island. It used to be when we were kids, from Labor Day to Memorial Day, there wasn't a lot of activity except the local people. Mm-hmm. Now, as the tourism spread, it began to, and of course the prosperity of the country, the retirees with nice retirement packages could perhaps sell a house in the Northeast for twice what they could buy one down here.
Sure.
So they'd have a nice retirement package from their company. They'd have a nice nest egg from selling their house and buying one that may have been a nicer house here than what they sold up there, but they got twice as much for the house up north as they did the one they bought down here. So we began to have a lot of retirees moving to the area. And some of them were a blessing to the area, and some of them weren't. It's that way probably everywhere. And eventually you've gotten to the point where between the beaches and the recreation aspect of the island and the retirement aspect of the island, I imagine there's a lot of people who love to see these two paper mills close down. I know when we closed down, the paper mills couldn't use us as the source of the stinking town. They had to accept their own responsibility. Mm-hmm.
Were they saying that it was the pogey plant that the smell would come from?
Yeah, we'd have the DEP come out from time to time and had said that they would, had some complaints about the odor. Mm-hmm. And it got to the point where, you know, when we were processing, we produced an odor. Mm-hmm. But we only processed when we caught fish. So, you know, if there's a northeaster blowing or there's other weather conditions that didn't allow us to fish, it got to the point there where we'd have to ask them specifically when the complaint came in, mm-hmm. to see if we even caught any fish that day that we could have produced an odor.
Mm-hmm.
And on many occasions, it couldn't have been us because we weren't processing any fish that day. And once we explained that to the, you know, the government officials, the DEP, then they figured out pretty quick what was happening, that the source of the odor wasn't us, it was somebody else.
So as we're wrapping up this conversation, I just wanted to give you an opportunity. Are there any, you know, specific memories or people from your time living here that you'd like to talk about?
Growing up here, baseball was a big deal. We had a mayor named Bill Melton. Everybody called him Mayor Melton. And he and Harry Johnson, and I can't remember, there's probably other people that were influential in bringing some major league farm clubs, that is, not the major league teams, but the minor league teams of the major league baseball team, to Fernandina for spring training.
Mm-hmm.
And so because of that aspect, our Little League baseball program got started in the 50s, and baseball has always been a big deal here.
Mm-hmm.
I can remember Billy Martin, that played with the Yankees, was a manager and came and spoke to our athletic club at the high school at a banquet, which was a big deal. And but baseball has always been the sport around Fernandina, and I think to some degree it still is.
Mm-hmm.
High school baseball team's done very well the last couple of years. But I remember our parish priest, Father Kelly, fondly. My Little League coach, Jimmy Clark, that worked at one of the paper mills but volunteered to coach very fondly. People that I work with, of course, you know, the Neil Franks of the world. And, Snooky Jones was one of the captains on our boat, and very good fisherman. And just a lot of people, you know, that we worked in. We had our character, Smiley Lee, of course, and that you probably heard a lot about. Was on our commission for a while.
Mm-hmm.
My older brother has served on the city commission. My dad served on the city commission. My Uncle Tracy served on the city commission. So our family's been active in the community for, you know, as long as we've been here.
Yes, sir. Well, before we end the recording, is there anything else that you'd like to add for this interview today?
I guess the point that I would like to make is for people to understand that the pogie industry sometimes is overlooked.
Mm-hmm.
People remember it from the odor and the smell, especially those that were early on, that, you know, before we got involved with some of the pollution aspects and or deodorizing, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
But it provided a good living for an awful lot of people for a lot of years. And I think that's been overlooked here. Mm-hmm. In Fernandina. I know just about everybody my age at one time or another may have worked at the pogie plant, some of them only for a day. used to go home, and my mother had a diaper pail in the garage that I would literally have to undress in the garage and put my clothes in it before I went and took my shower. When I got married, my wife continued that tradition. So I think our business is a good example of how the prosperity of the country affected certain industries. And it was a way of maybe a transition from, you know, an industry working society to more of a society that the middle class grew, the people wanted to recreate more, and some businesses suffered because of it.
Yes, sir.
And this is a good example of that. As the country got more and more prosperous, one of the things that I didn't mention was that when the industry moved into the Gulf of Mexico, if you look at that terrain down there, the geography of it, Louisiana, Mississippi to some degree, they don't have beaches. It's all bayous. And the fishermen were the first ones to go down and claim the high ground. And as the country got prosperous, there wasn't anywhere with no beaches down there. They didn't have a lot of people down there recreating, smelling the pokey plants. And so, therefore, they haven't had the pressure on them like on the East Coast, so to speak, from an environmental point of view. Now, certainly they have to, you know, take care of some environmental regulations, but they don't have the pressure on them that they would have if there was a, if they were on beaches, so to speak. And that's one of the things that commercial fishing industry as a whole, being the first ones to get on the water out of necessity. If you're going to go fish, you got to have a place to tie your boat up. But through the years, especially on the East Coast, that waterfront property has become much more valuable from a recreation and housing point of view than the decline that the fishing industry could provide. So more and more people that were in the fishing industry were selling their property, getting out of the fishing industry, so they could build condos or whatever else on the waterfront, so to speak. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
A lot of little fishing villages that I used to go to as a kid, no fishing at all there. None. There's only one pogie plant on the whole east coast of the United States, and that's in Virginia. So in 100 years, like I said, they went from 200 to 2. Now it's down to 1. But there's several on the Gulf Coast that are providing fish meal for this country.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your story today with me and the museum.